This is Jim Engster. Happy Memorial Day to you. Coming next on the show is Kenny Kleinpeter. He's the sexton for historic Highland Cemetery right here in Baton Rouge, a cemetery that's 2 centuries old, has Revolutionary War veterans buried there. We'll talk with Kenny Kleinpeter about the rich history of Highland Cemetery, appropriately on Memorial Day. And Tyler Bridges of the Lens, covering the Capitol as we near the finish line, 10 days to go in the session. He has some thoughts about the budget and the maneuvers by the governor and lawmakers. And we'll hear from former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb. He'll talk about foreign policy in the age of Obama. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. We start with Kenny Kleinpeter. He's the sexton for historic Highland Cemetery, located right here in our community, not far from the campus of Louisiana State University, a cemetery that's been around for a couple of centuries, quite a history. Kenny Kleinpeter, good morning to you.
Happy Memorial Day.
You're going to have to get closer. There we go.
And thanks for remembering.
Well, you've got a couple of Revolutionary War veterans who were buried there, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Quite a little bunch of characters in there.
Well, tell us how did that happen? That's obviously preceding Louisiana as a state, 1812. Revolutionary War, last time I checked, was in the previous century. How did they end up at Highland Cemetery?
You know, there was only one campaign outside of the 13 original colonies, and that was down here with the Galvez expedition, the Spanish contribution to this American Revolutionary War. And so you don't think about it, but Pierre-Joseph de Favreau is one of our interred revolutionaries that marched with Galvez and ended up staying here in charge of the Baton Rouge Fort. And even after he was assigned elsewhere, where later came back and retired here in Baton Rouge. So he's buried there in his family. Also, there's Armand Duplanchet. Dupletier, as the French say. And he was reportedly an aide-de-camp to General Lafayette. In fact, Lafayette came back to America for the 50th anniversary of the Revolution, and he visited every state in the Union, but one day in each, but spent 2 days in Louisiana because of his affinity or relationship with Armand.
So the cemetery opened in what year, approximately?
Yeah. Earliest documented burials are 1813.
1813, which would be 1 year after Louisiana became a state. So we're talking a couple of hundred years. Yeah.
That would be. Oldest surviving in East Baton Rouge Parish Cemetery.
Historic anniversary, 200 years. And for a while it was in kind of disrepair, wasn't it?
Ooh, about 250-year periods of that 200 years, it was a jungle.
When you say a jungle, what did it look like?
Completely overgrown. Nobody knew it was there. The church had even forgotten that it owned it, unfortunately. Families had moved on. The Civil War really was the beginning of the end for it, when most families had begun to bury closer to Baton Rouge at newly founded Magnolia and St. Joseph cemeteries.
How many people are buried there?
We think as many as 300, latest count. The cemetery is down to about half the size it was originally.
Of the 300, were most of them in the 19th century?
Yes, I'd say 80% were before the Civil War.
Before the Civil War?
Yes.
And the headstones, the graves have headstones?
Very few had them. We're learning, working with a great archaeologist, Ryan Seideman, and we have found little evidence of markers, and that's really one of the points of our work in the cemetery, is to recover markers, repair, and put them back. one of the most telling technologies that we use is actually very low tech, and it's probing, a systematic probe every 20 centimeters, which for a half acre cemetery is about 60,000 folks, recording exactly what I thought I hit at what depth up to a meter. And we found a lot of brick debris. That was the construction material of choice along the highlands with the river and the sand and clay.
All right. 297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with Kenny Klein, Peter, who has the title of sexton at Highland Cemetery. And for those unfamiliar, in fact, we've already gotten a few inquiries, the exact location, I said not far from LSU. We're talking south of campus. And for those who are cruising down Highland Road, what's the best way to get there?
Well, if it's in the College Town subdivision, the last place you'd think to find a 200-year-old cemetery. So if you'll just go to College Town Park, Breck's College Town Park, a sidewalk will lead you to our new entrance to the cemetery. We closed off the old entrance, which was very confusing to people. Oxford Avenue actually is two different roads or streets in College Town, so it's very confusing.
Do many people visit?
I'd say at least every day there are 5 to 10 people that come through there.
Well, to put it in perspective, Highland Cemetery, you say, opened around 1813. Or at least that's when the first person was buried there, probably opened a little before. But 1852 was the start of Magnolia Cemetery, which, of course, is a historic place, also before the Civil War, but about 40 years after Highland Cemetery was opened. If somebody wanted to be buried there today, could they?
Depends on how much money you have. it is owned by the church, you know.
The church being the Holy Roman Catholic Church, is
exactly.
that right?
Exactly. It's a Roman Catholic. It's actually St. Joseph Cathedral Parish is the administration of the cemetery. Father Paul Counts is the one who appointed me sexton. So I work closely with the church.
So would Counts be the guy to decide whether or not you could be buried there, Kenny?
Technically.
Well, I think if you know, you probably got a few good years left, but if you know, heaven forbid, if something happened to you after the show, it would be appropriate that you'd be buried at Highland Cemetery.
You think? You know, it is a tradition in years past that sextons who practically lived in the cemeteries of old would be buried and even had a certain section, but it is a sacred place, and I don't know if I'd be eligible.
Well, I like going through cemeteries. There's a certain aura that is there that in most any cemetery that is not when you're walking in a neighborhood or downtown or wherever you may be, but there's a peaceful quality to it, isn't there?
There very much is. This one being particularly sacred and historic. There's a little bit of something for everybody to reflect and get a good perspective of one's life. A cemetery has a life of its own. There is actually a phase when it's really attracted to people because they know people that are buried in there. There's an emotional tie. When that first or second generation goes, that's an inverse bell curve of where it practically gets forgotten. And essentially, somebody decides to develop it for other reasons, and that happens all too often today, since cemeteries are so 20th century. You know, so anyway, once it reaches the bottom of that bell curve, it starts to come up as a historic property, and people who are not related form an attachment to it for historic reasons. And Highland is one of those few that's come up to its second peak, and that's always wonderful when a civilization can remember its past like that.
You must be familiar with the cemeteries here in Baton Rouge.
Intimately, yeah. Yes.
What's your favorite?
Highland's my favorite. I've cut my teeth on her, but I have two other adopted cemeteries currently. One is Byrd Cemetery on Ben Hur Plantation that LSU Ag Department owns. The state technically owns that property.
Okay, well, that's one that's not well known either.
Even
lesser known than Highland.
Incredible story there. I think there's an American Revolutionary buried in that cemetery.
Really?
Abraham Byrd's father, who died in 1820. is
my goodness
most likely buried there.
And after Bird, your other adopted one?
Lutheran.
Yes.
That's the second oldest African-American cemetery in Baton Rouge after Sweet Olive. And it's in Old South Baton Rouge. And it's got about 5,000 burials, and I love working in that place.
Well, that's part of the vestige of segregation, is that we were segregated at death, too, back in the day, not too long ago. The headstones that are in place in cemeteries are always interesting, but I particularly like it when somebody has an epitaph that is curious. I went out to Westwood Cemetery last December in Los Angeles, and I noticed Rodney Dangerfield says, "There goes the neighborhood." And Merv Griffin says, "I will not be right back after this message." And there are a few other ones. Dean Martin says, "Everybody loves somebody sometime." Yeah. But,
have you thought of yours?
No. Merv is pretty good, but since he took it, I don't think I can take it. By the way, Mario Cuomo, a few years back in the New York Times, he said he wanted his epitaph to read, "He tried." And then like 2 weeks later, I read Bobby Jindal says he wants his epitaph to read, "He tried," which kind of gives me an indication that he might have read the story about Mario Cuomo. But it's not a bad one. He tried. And Buddy Leach told me that that's what he wants on his. He tried. But it's somewhat sad. My friend Ricky Stockner, for example, he died almost 6 years ago, and tragically, he does not have a headstone. He's buried at the Jewish cemetery. Some people do it by choice. For example, George C. Scott, no headstone. He was a man who refused to accept his Oscar, and he doesn't want to be recognized in death either. But I would imagine Stockner, the great producer, who died February 2nd, 2007, would like to have a headstone if he were still with us. Do you really have a grasp of the people who were there, or you just know there are 300 bodies somewhere in the ground at Highland Cemetery?
Well, we have various documents, maps that were done even as early as the 40s that showed the location of various family plots and about how many people were in each. So that, coupled with our probe technology that clearly shows 180 specific burial shafts, you can feel the difference between disturbed and undisturbed soil when you stick that low-tech instrument in the ground. So anyway, I added up, it comes to about 300.
Okay, so
probably is more.
So folks who are listening, if they want to pay a visit, do they have to go to the sexton, or can they just drop in any time, day or night?
As a good sexton, I actually live in the townhouse, I thought, adjacent to the cemetery, but the more I learn about it, the more I realize I'm over it.
297-5633 is your number, and there was a unusual noise. I hope that's not...
It's a ghost.
Kevin Gallagher's pointing at the board, but it is a remarkable place and a beautiful neighborhood, too.
Yeah.
And I imagine the folks who live in College Town are quite proud to have the Highland Cemetery in their midst. So you're nodding. Which it usually isn't a good thing for radio, but today I think we can get by on Memorial Day, and it's appropriate to remember the 1.3 million Americans who died in various wars since the Revolutionary War, fighting for the freedoms that we cherish and enjoy. Without them, we would not be doing a radio show of this kind at this point on this station. So we salute the fallen veterans who gave their lives for us. A memorial service honoring the life of Ralph Perlman will be held at Rabenhorse East Funeral Home, 2:30 tomorrow. The family will greet visitors at 2 o'clock. Ralph Perlman was a budget director under four governors in Louisiana. He died at the age of 96 after a brief illness. Born May 16, 1917 in New York City, the only son of European immigrants. So we remember Ralph Perlman fondly, and quite a man who served with distinction in Europe as an artillery officer with the 63rd Infantry Division. Also, congratulations to the LSU Fighting Tigers, SEC baseball tournament champions, beating Vanderbilt in extra innings, 11 innings, 5-4. Paul Maneri and his crew likely to be number one going into the NCAA tournament, and LSU will host one of the regionals at Alex Box Stadium. Thank you, Kenny Klein, Peter. Good to visit with you, and good luck at Highland Cemetery. And we will return with Tyler Bridges of The Lens after this brief timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In a few moments, not too many away, we'll hear from Tyler Bridges, the longtime reporter at the state capitol and beyond. He worked for the Miami Herald for 13 years, and he's back in Louisiana, and he's covering the state capitol, and we will talk with him about his latest work with The Lens. Steve in Mid-City. Steve, are you there? Good morning to you.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah. Yes,
hey, sir. Kenny. That's a special place for me, the Highland Cemetery, as you know. And before I tell you why, Jeff, I really enjoyed your singing Shall We Gather at the River yesterday at church. There is a placard there by a gravestone. I think it's Josephine Favreau. And she was betrothed to a young officer in that army that a stray bullet freakily killed him. My own son, finished Navy SEAL training, was driving home to meet his fiance here and went off the road in the desert and died. And at a memorial bench that was dedicated to him in Coronado, California, we read from the placard where Josephine says, my gosh, all this training, all this virtue, everything in life that goes into the building of a person, is it just lost at the grave? And then she proclaims, thanks be to God, we have the resurrection. And so it was a real special place for me to read that placard and for my son Dan's fiance to hear it. And in honor of him, Kenny and the cemetery allowed a sweet bay magnolia to be planted in his memory by Ward Bond.
Well, we thank you for sharing your remembrances, Steve. Good to hear from you, and appropriately, as I stated earlier, remembering Highland Cemetery on Memorial Day. And we'll have Kenny back soon. Good to see you, Kenny, and thanks to you, Steve, for calling. Tyler Bridges is now with us, the man who is the mastermind behind something called The Lens, and we've been with him a few times before on this show, and most recently in his new capacity. And as a noted, Tyler, you were with the Miami Herald 13 years. Is that correct?
That's correct, Jim. And if I can note Memorial Day, my father was a pilot during World War II, flew a B-24. It was shot down over Austria. He ended up becoming the first American prisoner of war in Hungary because he ended up crossing the border and ended up escaping from his prisoner of war camp in Yugoslavia. And ended up having seven kids. I'm the last one, and he died in 2003. So I just wanted to take a moment to honor my father's memory today.
That's a very good thing. He must have been born, what, around 1920 or so?
1919.
So he had lived a long life, 84 years, and I've never heard that story about your past. And, of course, you covered with vigor David Ernest Duke when he was running for office in Louisiana, wrote a book about him called The Rise of David Duke. And David Duke, I don't think there's any doubt, at one time in his life, and some would say to this day, was an admirer of Adolf Hitler. And yet, Tyler, he almost got elected governor of Louisiana.
Yeah, you'll remember, Jim, that in 1990 when he ran for the United States Senate, half the white people in the state voted for him against
actually
Jay
more
Bennett
more
Johnson.
Than more than more than half.
Yeah, a little more than half, and then the same thing in 91 in that epic runoff that you so well remember against Edwin Edwards.
Yes, and now we have a governor who's a much different kind of governor than Edwin Edwards was, and he is a minority. In fact, I think many people voted for him, who were probably on the left side of the political spectrum, because they thought it would be a good thing for Louisiana to have a person who was from a minority group, who's smart, Rhodes Scholar, Ivy League, and had a background in education. His mother came to this country by virtue of getting a job at LSU, and that's why Bobby Jindal was born in Baton Rouge. And then he was head of the higher education system in the state. And now he has been a very conservative governor, and some say not the best steward of higher education. Do you think that's a fair assessment, that he has kind of let the higher ed types down, or do you think he had no choice because of the budget quandary that he has faced? What do you think, Tyler?
Yeah, I would say that I'm not going to offer an opinion whether he's good for higher ed or not. I think the facts simply speak for themselves in that there have been hundreds of millions of dollars cut in higher ed under this governor. He has a very, very firm position against no new taxes, and that causes him to have lots, all sorts of budget cuts in areas that people, it seems like, they don't want, and also kind of ends up doing strange things, and that's the subject of my most recent story for The Lens.
The most recent one says unnoticed bill fills $87 million budget gap, but it breaks promise to repay savings. What is your read about the budget considerations that are ongoing in the final 10 days of the session, and in particular this $87 million expenditure?
Yeah, and actually, if you don't mind, Jim, if I could correct one thing on the air. You mentioned The Lens, and you said I'm the mastermind behind. I'm not actually the mastermind. That's some other people are that. I'm a reporter there, and I've been there since October. We're a nonprofit digital site people can look at for free. But this particular article, it really goes back to something that happened last year. Jindal not wanting to raise taxes, not wanting to make more cuts. He and the legislative leadership took $200 million out of the state's rainy day fund. Normally that fund is tapped for emergencies, but this time they said, well, we don't want to raise taxes, we don't want to make more cuts. But they said if we use this money, if we end up with a budget surplus, we're going to take that surplus next year and put that money into the rainy day fund. In fact, there was a $113 million surplus after the last fiscal year. But now they're saying they don't want to plug that money into the rainy day fund as they had promised to do last year. They're saying that they need to put that money, $87 million worth, to pay for to offset cuts by the federal government that came last year, and they're saying that those cuts and the federal government and the amount of money that the Congress is giving Louisiana for health care, that is forcing them to break the promise. At least that's what we know so far. This was a bill that neither the Senate leadership nor the general administration has it seems like they didn't really want people to know what they were doing. I found out about it and wrote about it. It passed a House committee with a Senate committee with absolutely, they're spending $87 million and there was practically no discussion. Really no one, I think, other than the inside crowd knew what was going on until I found out about it and wrote about it for The Lens. And then this will be on the Senate floor today. It's sponsored by John Alario. So I think the chances of it passing the Senate are pretty good. But it will face some opposition in the House.
Well, and it was found out about in a most unusual way, wasn't it? Another lawmaker was kind of surfing the net, or is that literally what happened?
It was discovered by Lance Harris, who is one of the fiscal hawks. It's a group that I've written a lot about this past year. A group of conservatives who think that Jindal is spending too much money and also not engaging in the kind of transparency that Jindal himself says is important. And Lance Harris is the leader of the House Republican delegation, but he had been very concerned about that promise from last year that the legislature keep its word. So he'd been trying to figure out exactly what was going to go on, and he found out that the Senate leadership and at least Representative Jim Fannin, who chairs the House Appropriations Committee, want to instead not put that money back in the rainy day fund, but put the money for the health care. And their argument is that, if they don't do that, the state will face big cuts in health care, particularly for the poor and the uninsured.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Tyler Bridges of The Lens. And it's you can go to thelensnola.org and find out much more about this story and others that Tyler has covered in his return to Louisiana this year. This particular one is at issue of how Governor Jindal and lawmakers can offset a loss of federal Medicaid money in 2012. Now, in 2013, they could have taken the Affordable Care Act money, the Obamacare funding, but have chosen not to. Is there any possibility this could change in the final 10 days of the session, or is this a done deal not to accept the Medicaid expansion spelled out under Obamacare?
Jim, I think you're right that they could have taken the money, and I guess it would have solved this budget problem on the health care and would have meant that they didn't have to break a promise. But I've seen no budging from Governor Jindal on his opposition to taking the federal money from Obamacare.
Does that surprise you?
No, and I hear so many people in the Capitol say that the governor's not going to do anything that would harm his chances of winning the Republican nomination for president in 2016, that he is very, very consistent on these sorts of issues because of that. You know, we don't know if that's true, but sort of the Capitol insiders think that that is just a very, very important issue for the governor, that he continue to, with this very conservative positioning, to appeal to Republican voters in other states.
You've covered national and state figures. Do you think Governor Jindal has the capacity to be elected president or to get the Republican nomination in 2016?
Jim, I have people all the time writing them off, saying for one reason or another that he has absolutely no chance. And I just feel like in covering politics, it's very important to keep an open mind about somebody. I can certainly understand the arguments as to why he wouldn't. And, in fact, any Republican candidate at this point is a long shot just because there's so many of them. And Charlie Cook, who you know so well, is such a great political handicapper in Washington, told me recently that Jindal at this point is in the third tier. But, Jim, how many candidates over the years have people written off and they ended up winning elections? And, remember this, Bobby Jindal is a very, very smart man. He's won the Super Bowl of Louisiana politics twice. He's proven very, very capable. He is, what I'm told, because I don't know him personally, is extraordinarily hard worker, very, very focused, and he seems to really have a burning ambition to make his mark on the national stage.
Well, we shall see. It looks as though he will go for the brass ring in 2016 and probably means he'll be spending a lot of quality time in Iowa and New Hampshire over the next few years. He already has, and he may be spending more time there in the next couple of years. Does that make his governing ability less palatable in Baton Rouge when he's often, as he was last year, 86 days of the year, he was out campaigning for others and of course, ingratiating himself with the Republican hierarchy?
Yeah, I've written about that. For example, Buddy Romer, who was governor from 1988 to 92, told me that he thinks Jindal needs to get his focus back on the state full-time, that just being governor is just so time-consuming, and then running for president on top of that, if indeed that's what Bobby Jindal is doing, is something that he just thinks that Jindal really needs to be more focused on the state. And one piece that I wrote for The Lens, and people could find it on the site if they tap, go back into the past articles, was about how this governor has really made no effort to become friends with legislators. And it served him well when he was very popular. But now he's run into a lot of political trouble, and he really doesn't seem to have any friends in the legislature or even among the statewide elected officials. He just doesn't spend time with any of them.
Well, as you know, as a reporter, sometimes you have to spend time with people you probably wouldn't associate with otherwise to get your job done. And I'm thinking back, and by the way, we had a listener who wanted to know where they could get a copy of The Rise of David Duke. I saw one, I think, at Cottonwood Books here in town, but obviously you can still get a copy online at Amazon, Amazon.com, I would think, Tyler.
They could. If somebody wants an autographed copy, I have several extra copies of The Rise of David Duke and also Bad Bet on the Bayou, if I could give out my
email
address. It's T.E.G. Bridges. teegbridges@gmail.com. Again, teegbridges@gmail.com. People can also follow me on Twitter at teegbridges.
All right, be careful there. Now, when you were covering Mr. Duke, as I recall, and you did some great work at that time and got stories that no one else was getting, it was because you were talking to a lot of people, including, in particular, an ex-girlfriend. She kind of spilled the beans on him, didn't she?
Yeah, I just think it's an important thing that you talk to everybody. You know, regardless of what your own political beliefs are as a reporter, you need to talk to people from all sides, and I'm doing that now in the state capitals and back in Louisiana, and, you know, trying to renew some contacts with some folks, but also getting to know some other people. And, you know, you got to be open to all points of view, and I'll listen to everybody, and ultimately your job is to get good information and present it in an honest and truthful way as you can to the public.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Tyler Bridges, and hopefully we'll catch up with you as we near the finish line for the 2013 regular session. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you, Jim.
And lawmakers are in session today, working on Memorial Day. LSU's open today, too, so that's good news. And our show is obviously on the air today. Our guest is Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He is the former assistant defense secretary under President Ronald Wilson Reagan. He's written 20 books and countless articles on national security issues, and we're here to talk with him about contemporary America and the rest of the world in the age of Obama. Good morning, Lawrence Korb.
Good morning.
What's your assessment of the president right now? He's somewhat embattled, but is it deserved?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at people are talking a lot about, the IRS situation and the, going after reporter stuff. I think in terms of, battle, most Americans aren't worried about press freedom. They should be, but most Americans aren't. IRS people can relate to it because we all deal with that. So if there's anything there, that's going to hurt them. Obviously, as Bob Gates, who was Secretary of Defense under both Bush and Obama, said, every day somebody in the federal government is doing something, wrong that's going to come back to haunt you that, you can't control all of them. I do think that IRS thing, will hurt them because I think most people focus, deal with the IRS in one form or another. And, when you get a call, I'm from the IRS and I'm here to help you, people don't like that. On the other hand, I do think that the speech he gave last week talking about, ending the perpetual state of war is something that will be welcomed by Americans and by historians because we just can't keep on going with this, war against terrorism that has no end.
297-5633. We're going to take a short pause, 90 seconds, and return with Dr. Lawrence Korb, also formerly Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And we'll talk with Dr. Korb about Benghazi and much more as President Obama tries to deflect controversy in his second term. This seems to be the rule when it comes to presidents from Reagan to Clinton to Obama. And remember, Ronald Reagan faced the Iran-Contra scandal in his second term. Are there any parallels, or is this stuff in Benghazi, is it overblown? We'll talk with Dr. Larry Korb some more when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Dr. Larry Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan, and now an active observer of American politics and warfare, and he is the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Dr. Korb, what about the parallels at this point between Iran-Contra, which engulfed President Reagan in his second term, and Benghazi, which right now continues to be a source of angst for President Obama?
Well, I would compare Benghazi more to what happened when I was in government, and that's the killing of the 240 American servicemen and mostly Marines in Beirut in 1983, because what happened initially when that, you know, we were aware of that, President Reagan said, well, it was unavoidable. Well, that turned out not to be true. My boss, Secretary Weinberger, had told him, you know, that this was mission impossible. You were putting these Marines, mainly Marines, into. There was no mission. You know, they weren't armed, and, you know, it was just inviting trouble. Then, like Benghazi, they appointed a commission, that time headed by a retired admiral, Bob Long, and they came out and issued a devastating report. Then, a couple of months later, Reagan came out and said, I take full responsibility for it. And then the Democrats, who controlled one house, like the Republicans control one house, held hearings and showed that, you know, there was a real failure in the chain of command. But after that, the Congress worked together to pass a, you know, an incredibly important piece of legislation called Goldwater Nichols. Everybody knows who Senator Goldwater was, but Bill Nichols was a conservative Democrat from Alabama, wounded in World War II, which basically, you know, said this is the way we need to set the Pentagon up. We gave the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff the authority they didn't have till then, and I'd say that was constructive. And so that was a little bit different. Everybody's trying to go on who said what to whom, and, you know, was it the State Department? Was it Petraeus? Was it, you know, Tory Nuland? And looking at this, I have to, you know, I smile, and people said, well, there's Victoria Nuland, the State Department, you know, spokesman. She was trying to prevent these talking points to say, you know, it wasn't the video. You know, Tory Nuland's a career Foreign Service officer who made her mark working for Dick Cheney. So the idea that somehow or another she was an Obama person, I'd like to see, so, okay, let's get on. What do we need to do? And I think we're making some steps in that direction. More Marines at the embassy, a Marine task force in Spain that can get into Africa, you know, if things happen. That's what we really need to do, rather than saying, you know, who said what to whom at what time.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Larry Korb. Hi, Dan.
Hey, I was just wondering if the U.S. invasion of Grenada was just a means of distracting the public from U.S. Marine barracks having...
It's interesting. A lot of people thought that at the time, but I can tell you I was there. Now, we were already planning to go into Grenada when, of course, this unexpected thing happened, you know, for the Marines. Now, you know, again, people said, oh, this is just, you know, to distract. No, that had already happened. I mean, you wouldn't have been able to plan it that quickly. And I know myself, I would, when the terrible things happened in Beirut, I was already on my way to Europe, and I was going to tell our ambassador to then West Germany to inform the, you know, the chancellor of then West Germany, you know, about the invasion.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Lawrence Korb.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, Jim, and happy Memorial Day. Yes, sir. I have to agree with you about the hearings. I mean, I kind of think it's clowns in suits with subpoenas, you know, just, you know, trying to make points against the administration. But my question, sir, is about foreign policy. You don't hear these kind of mistakes or scandals happening with China. China's been going into other countries and signing oil deals. I think they've been, you know, reaching into Africa and out to the Mideast. And now we have this treaty where we're looking to pivot to the Pacific. How is it that, you know, China seems to be having a lot of success out there compared to what we're doing?
Yeah, a good question, because a year ago, then Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and the president announced what they called the pivot to Asia, to basically kind of send a signal to the Chinese that, you know, don't push the envelope too much. And you're quite right. The real, you know, challenge in international politics over the next, you know, 10 or 20 years is, can a rising power like China, and they're rising, as you point out, be incorporated peacefully into the international system, or will the rivalry between the current superpower, the United States, and China lead to, you know, unexpected conflict? And that to me, you're quite right, that's the key thing. And I think the president in his speech the other day was trying to say, okay, you know, we're always going to have these terrorist attacks, whether it's, you know, the bombing that we had in the Boston Marathon, but the, you know, the fight against Al-Qaeda is over. We need to get back and kind of focus on the real challenges. And until we get our own economic house in order, it's going to be hard for us to, you know, to work with China the way that we should, because right now, you know, they're lending us money. I spent a couple of years in the Navy, and I know a lot of admirals, and they were saying, well, we need to buy more ships. I said, why? He said, to deal with the Chinese. And I said, and borrow the money from the Chinese. So we, you know, need to get our own economic house in order to be able to deal with China.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Larry Korb, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. President Obama is opening a new phase in the nation's struggle with terrorism. Last week, he announced that the U.S. will restrict the use of unmanned drone strikes that have been at the heart of Obama's national security strategy and shifting control of them away from the CIA to the military. Is this significant, Dr. Korb?
Well, I think it is, and I think two things about that speech are important. I mean, drones are an act of war. But we, the people in this country, don't focus on it to the extent we should, because no men and women's lives are, you know, at risk. But I think it's important if this president or any president is, you know, going to commit, an act of war, that we have the appropriate controls, the role of, you know, Congress in doing that. And if you shift it to the military, it's much different than the CIA, because under the CIA, you know, as we know throughout history, we've overthrown governments, and all the president has to do is, you know, notify a couple of, you know, the intelligence committees in Congress. But the military has much, you know, more stringent laws to get lawyers get involved and make sure that, you know, they're acting in the appropriate way. And then the CIA can get back to what they're supposed to be doing, which is gathering intelligence about what's happening in the world. And it's important to keep in mind how this happened. Mm-hmm. Back in the 90s, when drones were beginning to develop, the U.S. military didn't want to, you know, put much money into it, because they saw that as a threat to manned aircraft, which is more their essence, whereas the CIA did it. And then when we had the horrible attacks of 9/11, we had to rely on the CIA in Afghanistan, because they're the ones who had the drones.
297-5633 is your number. Now, Dr. Korb is also a member of the Honorary Board of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, an organization dedicated to ending discrimination against gay and lesbian people serving in the U.S. military. Now, there's a story that is out there. It was front page on the New York Times yesterday. A sergeant first class on the staff of the United States Military Academy at West Point has been accused of videotaping female cadets without their consent, sometimes when they were undressed in the bathroom or in the shower. The Army is contacting about a dozen women to alert them that their privacy may have been violated by the suspect, identified as Sergeant First Class Michael McClendon. The allegations at West Point, the nation's oldest and most prestigious military academy, come in the midst of growing outrage in Congress, at the Pentagon, and from the president over reports of sexual harassment and assault in the armed forces. What's going on, Dr. Korb?
Well, I think you have a couple of things happening. And, you know, there was last year, according to the Pentagon's own data, you had 26,000 cases of sexual violence. 3,000 were against males, and the rest were against, females. You have a couple of things happening here. One is the strains of war. When we created the volunteer military, you know, the idea was that if you got into prolonged conflicts like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, you'd call up the Guard and Reserve kind of as a strategic reserve, and then, you know, start, drafting people with the lottery system so that you could have a big enough force and make sure it was qualified. But nobody wanted to do that. So what we did is we didn't give a lot of the men, primarily men and women who were deployed, enough time at home in between deployments. And so it's not just a question of sexual violence. You got suicide, spousal abuse. You have a whole bunch of things happening. The other is that we lowered our standards. Between 2003 and 2007, and these are the Army and Marines' own term, we gave about 100,000 moral waivers for up to and including felony convictions to take people in. So you have this strain, you have people there that, you know, don't belong. That's a contributing factor to it. And then there's a feeling on the part, unfortunately, of some, particularly males in the service, that women don't belong there, or, you know, the whole, you know, culture. There was an article in yesterday's Washington Post by Anu Bhagwati, who was a Marine captain, and she was talking about how when she was deployed to Thailand with the Marines, you know, the men were going to brothels. I mean, you know, and therefore, you know, you create that type of culture. And her solution, which I agree with, and I wrote this a couple of years ago, you need to take when people complain about sexual violence, you need to take it out of the chain of command and, you know, make sure that, you know, that the people who make the accusations have proper legal representation. And you need to make more women in higher posts. I mean, I think we have 6 members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. At least one of them should be a woman, you know, to send that message that women are here to stay. They're co-equal and should not be treated in this way. So you're really going to have to, you know, change. People forget that when the military integrated back in 1948, there were a lot of problems for many, many years before they got that right.
Now, you speak as one who served in the military. You were in the U.S. Navy, a captain, served on active duty for 4 years. Also, Larry Korb was a professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy and at the Naval War College. Is it a concern of yours that so many of the leaders in Washington, and let's start with the president and the vice president, no military experience at all? Does that really matter?
Yeah, I do. I'm concerned because it's not just members of Congress. You have much, you know, fewer that have been there. And, you know, I think it really hurt us, you know, particularly in the invasion of Iraq when we thought we'd be greeted as liberators because you had a president and vice president who not only, you know, didn't serve,
well,
but should have served.
That was Dick Cheney, who got six draft deferments, I think.
Right, yeah. And, you know, President Bush, who was able to get into the Guard. You know, getting into the Guard during the war in Vietnam, because we knew Johnson wasn't going to deploy, it was like kind of trying to win the lottery, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I do think that did hurt. And, you know, I've written this, you know, President Clinton, Vice President Biden, Bush, and Cheney all were of draft age and avoided it. Now, with the coming of President Obama and I think the next generation, where you didn't have a draft, you're going to have less and less people. But I do think that is important because I remember when I was in Vietnam and one night I got lost and ran into this Catholic monastery and trying to get directions back. And this monk basically said to me, "Why do you think you guys are going to make out any better than the French here?" And I always remember that. And when first time I went to Iraq, it was almost the same thing. Why do you guys think you're going to be any different than the British here? And I think you need to understand that before you go into a foreign country. And if, you know, Bush and Cheney, you know, had been there, I think they would have been a little bit more sensitive to people saying you're going to be greeted as liberators. It's going to be a cakewalk. That just doesn't happen.
Well, we thank you for your service to the country and for joining us today on Memorial Day. Dr. Larry Korb. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks
appreciate
a lot for having me.
Have a
Bye.
Good holiday. Bye-bye. Some stories to close the day with. Big success, number 4 for Bayou Country Superfest, and it'll be back in 2014. Saw Mayor Kip Holden at about midnight last night, and it's amazing. You had all these folks outside taking their photos with Mayor Holden, probably most of whom at Bayou Country Superfest did not vote for him. But he was a rock star in a country music setting last night as Zac Brown closed down the Bayou Country Superfest. And Mayor Holden says it will have a spinoff value to the city of $30 million. So another success for the city. And it was quite a night and quite a weekend at Tiger Stadium. Now, after years of grueling battles over state budget deficits and spending cuts, California now has a new challenge on hand. Under the leadership of Governor Jerry Brown, a projected budget surplus in the Golden State of $4.4 billion. And this is the Jerry Brown who inherited just an amazing budget catastrophe from his predecessor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he has righted the ship in the Golden State. And perhaps Jerry Brown, who was once a close friend of Edwin Edwards and actually got the nod in 1976 for president from Edwin Edwards over Jimmy Carter. Edwards endorsed Jerry Brown. Perhaps Jerry Brown could come to Louisiana and offer some tips to Bobby Jindal. Maybe Governor Jindal would be receptive to a fellow Ivy Leaguer, Jerry Brown, graduate of Yale Law School, coming to Baton Rouge and offering some tips. They do have some things in common. They're both Roman Catholics, both extremely bright individuals, but Governor Brown has apparently waved a magic wand of sorts in the Golden State, and he could offer some tips to his much younger governor, fellow governor, Bobby Jindal. Jerry Brown was governor of California in 1974 when he was 36 years old. He is now, he's 75 years old. Imagine that, 75 years old. So he definitely is old enough to be Bobby Jindal's father. Governor Jindal will celebrate birthday number 42 on June 10th. Story today, the top story out of the Capitol is that snakes have been found in the state capitol, and some would say there's some poetic justice to this, but let's hope the snakes don't get loose at the Capitol. We wouldn't want that in the final 10 days of the regular session, but we will follow it right here on WRKF. We thank you for joining us. Have a great holiday. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.